Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a very important show for you today. In a lot of ways, it's all about ringing the bell, blowing the horns, and calling attention to what's happening in this country under the rule of Donald Trump. When Trump first came into power, we sounded an alarm about the threat of fascism in the form of the Trump regime and the need for people to stand up and stop it before it has the chance to consolidate its rule and unleash unthinkable horror on the world. More than 2 years later, Trump is still in power, and it should be clear for all with eyes to see that this can only bring immense horror and suffering on the people here and worldwide. Those who have stepped up against this regime are courageous, but still, the tide of opposition needed to stop these Nazis has not mushroomed in the way that it is needed if fascism is going to be defeated. Yes, there's a crisis in the system, an impeachment crisis, and the Democrats have been painting a clear picture of the abuse of power by the Trump regime. We're also a year away from another election, a year, and the usual spectacle is ramping up, with seemingly dozens of candidates. Nowhere in all of this, in the hearings in Congress, or in the overpopulated debates of the Democratic Party candidates, do you hear them using the F word, fascism. The fact is, this regime will continue to do whatever they can get away with. The Democrats haven't stopped them from crimes against humanity or assaults on the right to dissent or dismantling the rule of law. They don't even mention the children in concentration camps and rarely speak about the destruction of the planet. They seem interested only in protecting the parts of their political system in which they have a stake. And their ideas of impeachment and removal or defeating Trump in the 2020 elections do not even take into account the very real possibility, based on Trump's own statements, that he will refuse to leave office even if removed by Congress or voted out in the next election. The Democrats' insistence on relying on the system itself and staying out of the streets leaves people completely unprepared for such likely events. It's really up to us, the ordinary people in the U.S. If we fully understand what is happening and what it means for humanity, we have an obligation to humanity to do all we can to stop this regime and its consolidation of fascist rule. We're going to speak about this topic today, what it has in common with the Nazi regime in Germany that led to war and unspeakable horrors, and what this has in common with what we see growing in the U.S. today. At the back end of the show, we'll be listening to an interview I did a while back with Claudia Kunz, an historian of Nazi Germany and the author of numerous books on fascism, including Mothers in the Fatherland and the Nazi Conscience. And we'll be talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on what has developed and taken root in the U.S. and the very real threat that an all-out Nazi regime is fighting to firmly establish itself here. And before that, we'll hear from Bob Avakian on the Democratic Party, a major instrument of this monstrously oppressive system. Before that, we'll be listening to a song about the police murder of Eric Garner, a black man who was strangled by New York police for selling loose cigarettes in Staten Island. Eric Garner was savagely beaten and strangled, even as he cried out, "I can't breathe." In the years since that murder, more than 2,000 people have been murdered by the police around the country, and those are just the ones we know about. Most recently, two young black men were shot down by the police in California for simply being a young black man. Stephen Clark was gunned down in his grandmother's backyard in March of 2018. And in February of 2019, six police in Vallejo, California, shot 20-year-old Willie McCoy as he lay sleeping in his car in a Taco Bell parking lot. Sisters and brothers, this is genocidal. We all have a responsibility as human beings to stop it. And in that spirit, I want to play a song titled "I Can't Breathe," written and recorded by family members of Eric Garner, the man who was murdered by the New York City police in 2014. And opening the show up, we will be talking with historian Peter Fritchie. I am very pleased to welcome to the show my next guest. He's historian Peter Fritchie, who's the author of Life and Death in the Third Reich and Iron Wind, Europe Under Hitler. And one that really knocked me out is Germans into Nazis. And we're talking about how ordinary Germans became supporters of Hitler and the Nazis and complicit in unspeakable horrors. Peter, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Michael. Thanks.
Yeah, let's jump right into it, man. Let's talk about how Germany became a fascist country ruled by a brutal dictator for more than 10 years.
You know, and it's interesting because when people talk about this, we were talking earlier, when people talk about this, there's references to some kind of trickery that enabled all this to happen. But he did actually win an election that people voted in, right?
Well, he did. And there's two extraordinary events that happened in the early 1930s. One is the huge rise of the votes for Hitler between 1930 and 1933. And in a parliamentary system, he topped out at 37%, coming from nowhere. That's a huge number. And that gave him a kind of democratic legitimacy. Moreover, he had a press empire. He had thousands of supporters. He had paramilitary troops. So he had real political power that was visible to almost all Germans by 1932, 1933. But he didn't have everybody. There are millions of socialists, millions of communists, millions of Catholic voters who are not necessarily for Hitler. But within 100 days of the last election in Germany in March 1933, he had completely dismantled democracy, prohibited all political parties, and was riding a wave of popular enthusiasm that historians today are still trying to understand. It was a grassroots movement. It was not funded by big business. It had its ups and downs, and we have to understand why it went up. But this was definitely a democratic movement for pursuing anti-democratic ends in an extremely resolute way.
You know, one of the things that's really, I think we really have to dig into, because it's sort of, you know, you can see it happening now on another level, but at this point, but it actually has a lot of potential for repetition here. And the whole point of this popular myth around how Nazi rule of Germany was imposed, you know, you've argued in your books that there was actually a reason why Germans became Nazis.
There is a factor of imposition. You did imprison tens of thousands of socialists and communists in 1933, but this is a popular movement. Nazism was popular because it was different. It wasn't a big business party. It was not associated with middle-class interest groups, and it was not associated in the minds of its voters with socialism, communism, and internationalism. It was a third way that combined, in the minds of Nazi voters, social progressive policies that would invite workers back into the nation, but would also think Germany first, that Germany had been humiliated at the Treaty of Versailles and that needed to gather all its national energies in order to act on the international stage and recover economically. So the name of the Nazi party is NSDAP, and that means National Socialist German Workers' Party. That acronym is basically the explanation for why the Nazis were able to profile themselves as a new and different force, especially in economically bad times when people were rejecting what they called the system in droves.
You know, one of the things that really troubled me is when I'm reading this and I'm studying this stuff and reading your books, and I keep thinking, in addition to the people who were like really jumping into the Nazis, you know, and loving the Nazis, others remained supportive, but actually they liked the new society, but they didn't like the Nazis. And that they sort of managed to find some kind of common ground where they became involved in everything that the Nazis were doing on the ground in the country at the time. And this actually means that they accepted a lot of the stuff that was the buildup to, and pretty quickly, the horrendous stuff, the unspeakable stuff that was done by the Nazis.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I make a distinction between Nazis and the Third Reich. And you could love the Third Reich. You could support the National Revolution in 1933, but not necessarily like the Nazis down the block. And in a dictatorship, it's much easier for corrupt, nepotistic local leaders to be quite powerful. And there's no doubt that lots of Germans mistrusted the local brown shirts in the neighborhood. But the big revolution, the National Revolution as it was called, and the larger project of building a Third Reich, of healing the divisions of German history, of creating a sort of an ethnic consciousness that would make Germany strong again, both inside and outside its borders, that was indeed widely accepted and won increasing assent. And indeed, in 1945, many, many Germans blamed the Nazis for betraying and destroying the Third Reich.
Peter, tell me this. There's actually, at the same time as you're talking about all this, this point about people themselves turning a blind eye at best and sometimes actually justifying a lot of horrendous things that the Nazis ended up doing. And this was especially in relation to Jewish people. Reading your books, I sort of got a sense of like, okay, but people turned a blind eye to this, and sometimes even sort of welcomed it as, you know, necessary. Let's talk about that a little.
Germans had a deep desire for a unified and peaceful and affluent community, but they understood, and this is what the Nazis drove home, and this is the myth that they won. Something happened in 1918 when Germany lost the war. It was betrayed from within. And the only way you're going to get your affluent, peaceable ethnic community is to slay the enemies that betrayed you in 1918. Who exactly those enemies were, people differed. It could be communists, it could be the Jews, it could be someone else. But they understood that there had to be eradication, cleansing, violence in order to reach the desired community imagined in the golden ages of the past, but also then projected onto the future. So there was a willingness to accept ruthlessness and a willingness to say, well, we can't have Judeo-Christian morality. We have to think as Germans and determine our actions on the basis of what helps Germany. Never before in modern history have people so identified their individuals with the body of the nation. And thinking like that means, if you think in terms of betrayal, if you think in terms of a Germany that somehow was lost but could be regained, then you have to move against the betrayers. You have to move against the treason. That was the communists, and that was the Jews. People were complicit in accepting Nazi violence. I don't think the Germans would have voted for the Holocaust, but they accepted the exclusion of people who had previously been considered German citizens because they had an ethnic-based idea of the German future. And this proceeded extraordinarily quickly. Within weeks of when the Nazis won their last elections, people became experts on the Jewish question. How many percent of Jews should be lawyers, should be doctors? Had Jews proven themselves in World War I? However you framed the question, the Jews were different. And that was the first step, the violent exclusion of people who were otherwise your neighbors. Simply by saying Heil Hitler instead of good day, you changed everyday interactions. And so the exclusion of Jews from German life, what's called the cold pogrom, happened as much from below as it did from regime proclamations. And it wasn't necessarily at first a brutal violence, but it was the exclusion of your Jewish neighbors from the newly defined German community. And people wanted the Third Reich and therefore were willing to accept, even if they did think that there were what they called excesses, were willing to accept them because they thought in ethnic terms and the Jews were on the other side.
So that was sort of a level of complicity in it, even if they didn't think that that was it. And in your book, Life and Death in the Third Reich, you talk about how a lot of towns, a lot of cities where Jews would disappear and or they would be people would see them getting on the trains or being trucked out. And then they would rush to get their belongings or, you know, buy their belongings at a local flea market or take over their apartments, which is a level of complicity that is sort of astounding.
It's extraordinary. Now, of course, most people weren't involved in that, but a lot of people were. The fact that Jews were being deported in the fall of 1941 and then again in the spring and summer of 1942 was known. Then, often visibly, the Jews were brought to the train stations via buses or marches or on the streetcars. The apartments were then empty, and auctions were held, and auctions were advertised in the newspapers. And then people, you can read this in the diaries, had to make decisions whether they were going to buy Jewish linens and sleep in them or whether they weren't.
There's some chilling comparisons with the current Trump-Pence regime in the U.S., and anybody who's listening to the show has to have thought that well before I just said that, with regard to immigrants and oppressed nationalities, you know, deportations, arrests, demonization, police terror, etc. Let's talk about that.
I ask my students when I teach my Holocaust class, we say, why were people not outraged back then? What outrage is happening to us today that our grandchildren will say, why weren't you outraged? And I have two answers. One is our huge prison population and the willingness to see illegal immigrants and their families being torn apart. You go to El Paso, you go to Nogales, you go to the border towns, people are scared. People are being taken because they're presumed to be illegal. And illegal under the new administration means also probably more criminal. And that means you're assigning evil features to a collective group. This is very dangerous. More dangerous is the idea that somehow we lost America, that America was somewhere in the past, was great, but it hasn't been, but it could be again. That means your enemies are small in number, but sinister, and you have to get rid of them. If only had we not done these and these and these things, that creates internal enemies. And that kind of thinking is extremely dangerous, that there was a wholesome America, and now we're going to get it back. And we're going to get it back by eliminating or getting rid of or somehow undoing the harm between then and now.
Mm-hmm.
And does that mean getting rid of civil rights? Does that mean getting rid of simple empathy when we talk about 11-year-old children or 15-year-old children or 17-year-old children who were perhaps not born in this country but belong in it? It's a whole question of how you define belong.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you change the definition of belonging, you're policing that new border.
Wow. Yes, absolutely. Peter, one more question. When I first approached you about coming onto the show, I wrote to you and told you what I wanted to talk about on this first edition, because you are going to be back in about 2 weeks, I think. But I approached you about it and told you what I wanted to talk about. And you wrote back to me, remember this, no one could save Jews in 1942 in front of the gates of Auschwitz. You could only save those who would later, and at that point unknowingly, be murdered if you accepted refugees in 1938, that is poor, non-English-speaking, possibly communist refugees. And that, of course, was unacceptable and not done. Let's talk about that.
It was not done, and you can look at the Acts of Congress. So we all would vote. We would all say, no, don't gas people in Auschwitz, of course. You're not saving people from the gates of Auschwitz. You're saving homeless, persecuted, lonely, scared people in 1938 with all of their foibles. They're called refugees, and they could be us.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Syria 10 years ago. I never imagined, could never imagine this. And now, so many millions of the people in that country, perhaps people I met, have no home and no future.
All right, Peter, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Yeah, and talk to you again in about 2 weeks.
Look forward to it.
Me too, man. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with historian Peter Fritschi, and we've been talking about basically the situation in Nazi Germany and the parallels it has to what's going on here today as well. What happened there? How did that actually happen? It's not a mystery. You can actually uncover the causes of all this and look and compare with what's happening in this country today, what's being done.
My face kissed the wall, as sure as the sun shines. can get another one, lose my house. I can get another one, lose my mind. I create another one. They took my brother and I can never get another one. I'm tired of a system that will never love me. A system that took my brother from me. No matter how much money I receive, I can hear my brother crying, I can't breathe.
I can hear my brother crying, I can't breathe. Now I'm in this struggle and I can't leave. We all know the solution, but they blame you.
Even as fascism continues to consolidate its rule, we are told not to worry, to just go about our lives and close our eyes to the horrors unfolding before us. And while the fascist Trump regime continues to hammer down its rule, we are told that if we want to stop this regime, we should work with and rely on the Democratic Party. Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, described the Democratic Party as a major instrument of this monstrously oppressive system. This is an excerpt from one of his recent talks, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. You can find this entire talk at revcom.us.
From everything that has been said so far, it should be clear why the fundamental change that is needed cannot be brought about by voting. Of course, those who care about and are determined to do something about oppression and injustice are constantly bombarded with the notion that it is crucial to vote for the Democrats, because at least they sometimes say they care about this. And this has become all the more intense and insistent with the rise to power of the Trump-Pence fascist regime and its backing by the politicians of the Republican Party, which has itself become a fascist party at its core. It is crucial to vote for the Democrats, they tell us, in order to do something to limit the harm Trump can do. The leaders of the Democratic Party refuse to say that Trump should be removed from office now, and they insist that even talking about that only plays into Trump's hands. But because of the way the electoral system has been set up from the beginning of this country, with the Electoral College instead of direct popular election of the presidents, and small states having as many senators as states with much larger populations, all of which, by the way, was part of the compromise with the slave states, and which represents today the continuing legacy of slavery. And with the way elections for Congress have been manipulated through suppression of the votes of especially black people and Latinos, as well as the gerrymandering of districts, that is, structuring them in ways that are geographically distorted, so that people who intend to vote against the Republicans are concentrated in a few voting districts, while those, especially conservative white people, who would vote Republican are spread out through a number of such districts, giving them a greater disproportionate number of congressional representatives. Because of all this, it is far from certain that in the upcoming midterm elections, the Democratic Party will be able to pull off its blue wave to regain a majority in Congress. And what is the approach of the Democrats in attempting to achieve this? To a large degree, it is to run candidates and campaigns they hope will appeal to Trump voters, including candidates who boast of their service in the U.S. military, carrying out bombing raids and other devastation in the Middle East and Afghanistan. The truth is that not only is it necessary to overthrow the system in order to put an end to what is concentrated in the five stops and the horrific conditions to which the masses of humanity are subjected in a world dominated by this system of capitalism and imperialism. But even short of revolution, even in order to prevent the Trump-Pence regime from further consolidating its rule and more fully implementing its fascist program, it is necessary to rely not on the Democratic Party, but on masses of people, breaking out of the confines of politics as usual and carrying out sustained, nonviolent mass mobilization to drive out this fascist regime. In fact, a major role of the Democratic Party is corralling and domesticating dissent. For example, at the time of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, when there was a massive outpouring of opposition to that war, the Democratic Party as such was not in a position to co-opt and derail this dissent because, with some exceptions, Democrats in Congress voted for this war. So they utilized the organization Move On as a kind of oppositional force whose main role was to lure people who were alienated by the war and by the Democratic Party's support for the war back into politics as usual, back into the framework and confines that had produced that war in the first place. More recently, the Democratic Party and those aligned with it have done the same thing with regard to the anger and disgust that literally tens of millions feel toward Trump. And in some ways, the Democrats have actually positioned themselves to the right of Trump, especially in their insistence that the basic problem with Trump is that he is undermining America's dominant position in the world, when in reality, the America First actions of the Trump-Pence regime are aimed at increasing that domination in ways that represent a grave threat to humanity. In case there were a need for further evidence of what the Democratic Party is really about, here are two other striking examples. At the Democratic Party convention in 2016, former CIA head Leon Panetta and Marine General John Allen, a former commander of U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, were featured speakers. And when some people at the convention responded by chanting, "No more war," they were met by attempts of the convention officials to silence them, and then they were drowned out by the mainstream of the Democratic Party delegates bellowing, "USA! USA! USA!" And it's just as ugly as that. And let's not forget that when black youth in Baltimore rose up in righteous rebellion after the police murdered Freddie Gray, Barack Obama denounced these youth as thugs. But he never denounced the police who killed Freddie Gray as murdering thugs. I could go on and on. There is more than a mountain of evidence that shows the actual nature and role of the Democratic Party as a major instrument of this monstrously oppressive system. But there is an even more basic problem. The truth is that the governing politicians, the owners and operatives of the multi-billion dollar media of various kinds, and others who sit atop the major institutions of this society are the political and cultural representatives of this system. Just listen to them when they talk about the role of the U.S. empire in the world. It is our interests, our military, our allies, and on and on and on. And the deeper truth is that it would be impossible for them to be anything other than representatives and functionaries of this system. This is why even stubborn efforts by well-intentioned people to turn the Democratic Party into a positive force are bound to fail. Once again, we are back to the economic relations and the operation of the economic system, the social relations bound up with this, and how this determines the character of the political system and the dominant culture. If the political system operated in conflict with these underlying relations, the society could not function. For this fundamental reason, political parties, which have a major role and influence in this society, are and could only be ruling class parties, representatives of the ruling capitalist class, instruments of this system of ruthless oppression, administrators and enforcers of a worldwide empire of exploitation and plunder, responsible for massive destruction and devastation of countries and people, and posing a very real and growing threat to the very existence of humanity through environmental destruction or nuclear annihilation.
Once again, that was Bob Avakian speaking on the Democratic Party and the danger of trying to rely on them in the fight against fascism. And now we'll be hearing an interview I did with Claudia Kunz. Claudia Kunz, who is a historian of Nazi Germany, she teaches at Duke University. Claudia, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Let's first talk about how, in broad strokes, your book, you pick it up and you start reading it, and it's very difficult to put it down. And it's very difficult to sit there and not, like, have your bones chilled as you're reading it when you're looking at this and you're saying, how the hell did this happen? So in broad strokes, let's talk about how fascism developed in Germany.
Okay, first of all, let's remember that nobody ever heard of Hitler until the early 30s. He was unemployed. The only steady job he ever had in his life was when he fought in World War I for 4 years. He was quite brave. This was a splinter party. In 1928, as late as 1928, 10 years after the defeat in World War I, the Nazis got 2.6% of the vote. 1930, they got 18% of the vote. 1932, they were up to the high point ever, 37.4% of the vote. So the Nazis never were voted into power. Hitler was appointed into power. So the question is, how did this disreputable fringe party of loudmouth, brawling stormtroopers get from a tiny splinter party to the center in 1932, which put Hitler in position to get appointed as chancellor, because he was like the prime minister, there was a president above him. Okay, what happened was the Great Depression. Suddenly, one-third of all Germans were unemployed. The government was in gridlock. People were desperate, and Goebbels, Hitler's sidekick for media, had an important insight. He said, we can use democracy to kill democracy. We come, this is a famous statement, we come like wolves to the sheepfold. We will take over. And so that's the crucial thing to look at. What happened between 1930 and 1934 that landed Hitler in a position where he was prime minister, chancellor? And part of that answer has to do with the incompetence and the cluelessness of his opponents, who didn't think he was very dangerous until too late. And also, one thing I should remind you of is that the Germans were educated. Their voter turnout was above 88% all the way through the whole Weimar Republic. These were smart people. And Hitler was appointed chancellor January 1933, still didn't have a majority. He had to get a majority. Then what happened is the Reichstag burned down. It would be like the Congress, the House of Congress, was burned down. The fire was sufficiently bad. Hitler blamed it on the communists. He called the representatives to the Reichstag, kept communists out, and this time there was another election, the national election. Hitler still only got 44% for the Nazis. And finally, in the middle of March 1934, the government, that is, the politicians, did what the people didn't. The politicians caved in and voted Hitler as chancellor. And from that point forward, he just moved so fast, nobody caught up to him.
You know, it kind of models and reminds you of what happened with Trump and the way he got put into office.
Right. So it'll be from completely outside. The outsider has so much credibility just because of their incompetence, because of their lack of experience.
Then you have the Electoral College that actually had some kind of role to play in, like, looks like we're going to put this guy in because we want him.
We are in a lot more trouble constitutionally than Germany was. Germany had a great constitution.
In the book, you talk about the road to Auschwitz was paved with righteousness, and I thought that was an important point for people to think about.
Right. Ordinary people can't do evil unless they see it as good, unless they see it as protective. So until the 1980s, the Germans said, oh, we didn't know anything about it. Then they said, well, maybe people knew about it, but just an evil, you know, a few bad apples. Then the next question, well, maybe they were just like robots. And I wrote my book, actually, The Mothers and the Fatherland, in this one, to point out that you can't deport from Nazi-occupied territories. You can't have Germans deporting 675,000 other Germans that who were Jewish and unwanted without a lot of collaboration at the local level. And people have to believe that what they are doing is protective because they believe they're in such great danger, like in a wartime. That's the question. How people feel righteous and good when they do the very evil thing of sending friends and neighbors, betraying friends and neighbors at the grass level.
It's
collaborating in the actual killing sites.
And it's heavy because it's something that gets repeated throughout the entire history of that regime. It's very, very heavy, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, too. But your title of the book is Nazi Conscience, and you begin it by saying that Nazi conscience is not an oxymoron. But as I was telling you earlier, it kind of made my head snap, you know, because, and to many people, the words of Nazi and conscience are never conceived of as two words that would go together anywhere.
We're so naive, we believe that there's a universal conscience, like thou shalt not kill. And do unto others. But actually, when you think about it, Freud had this insight too. He said it's hard to do unto others who are not like yourselves. And that reminds me of a Nazi slogan. Do unto others as you would like others to do unto you. But in the German, it's clearer. Others are people like you. Do unto others who are like yourself.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and A Nazi Conscience, and we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on recent developments in the U.S. and the threat of the consolidation of a fascist government here. There's another point that you raise in this, which is, again, really struck me. You quote Carl Schmitt. And he was a big Hitler supporter. He denounced the concept of universal human rights when he was questioned about that. And he denounced it by saying, you know, listen, not every being with a human face is a human. And you say that this statement, which just sort of makes your head spin, you say that this is the bedrock of Nazi morality. What do you mean?
What I mean is Schmitt didn't think Jews had a human face. He looked at their faces. The visual is so important. He looked at their faces and he said, these people are subhumans. There are also people who are racially, well, they're disabled, but he said these people are not worthy of life. Life unworthy of living was a Nazi medical belief. And so they were able to sense whole categories of human beings outside of the realm of moral obligation. Let me give you an example. A young man in the eighth grade, in 1938, he saw his best friend Heinz being taken off in 1938, being taken off to a concentration camp. It was his best friend. Heinz and he grew up together. And he said, looking back, his name was Philip, he said, you know, when I saw them taking Heinz, I didn't say, isn't it terrible they're taking Heinz? He said, isn't it a shame that Heinz is a Jew? That's what happened to his conscience. And he grew up later, came to this country, he wrote a book, and he recognized his ways. But that was his view.
When you're talking about that, it's kind of heavy because it's like this point about a normalization that grew up around fascist rule in Germany. And it lasted quite some time. But I keep wondering, how the hell did this happen? There's all these people, like you said, there's these people who thought this, they thought that, they recognized what Hitler was saying, but they thought that it was part of their moral stand or whatever, and that it was something that was okay to be doing for the interests of Germany. How did this happen? And what was this normalization around fascist rule in Germany up until 39? What actually made that work?
Well, let's think about one of the reasons it worked is because Hitler engineered an economic recovery. Hitler understood that he needed experts in his cabinet, for example. His first cabinet had 12 members and only 3 were Nazis. And the genius behind the economic recovery was actually a founding member of the German Democratic Party. And he was a Keynesian. They borrowed tremendously. And here was his formula. Massive rearmament, because Germany had been disarmed after World War I, infrastructure development, lots of big construction projects, and then labor-intensive projects to give people jobs, like the WPA in the United States. And so all that was going on. By 1936, there was no more unemployment. 3 years, unemployment went from 30% to zero. And all this time, Hitler's diplomatic corps, who were extremely skilled, were being appeased by the West. So Hitler was going from one diplomatic victory to another. And so the combination of domestic rebuilding and international prestige made Hitler very popular. And let's also remember, the Germans read Hemingway. They loved Gone with the Wind. They read Faulkner. They drove Fords. They drank Cokes. They went to church. Germans got the first paid vacations of any workers in the world. They went to mass motels and cruise ships. just the very first week of Nazi power, just for example, and how important the psychology was, the Nazis were geniuses at this. People in small towns that were buildings were looking kind of shabby got free house paint if they repainted the outside of their houses just so it looks better. That's what normalization looked like. And so people then had a kind of yes-but attitude. Yeah, the Nazis are terrible, but look what they did. So there was a record of real achievement that is hard for us to remember, but it was real.
Now, Claudia, let's talk about this. Who was the actual social base for the Nazis and Hitler, and why?
Yeah, first of all, the Germans keep very good records, so we know how every little district voted for the whole 13 years before the Nazis took over. They even tabulated male and female votes separately. How did they do that? They had women vote on white slips and men vote on gray slips. So we have an exact knowledge of who voted for Hitler. And who voted for Hitler we would call today the left behind, the people who felt that they were not getting a fair share, that the cities were booming, that the wealthy people were doing okay despite the Depression. They had been through a terrible inflation in 1923. They felt they lost everything. These were the left behind. But the other thing we know, because we have such good voting records, is we say, okay, look at the Nazi Party vote increase, and we can see what parties, and there were five major parties, which parties lost votes to the Nazis before 33, and who held their own. The parties that held their own votes were the socialist parties, the Catholic parties, and the communist parties. These three parties were parties that we can't even imagine today because they were subcultures. They had sporting events. They had singing events. They had paramilitary marching. So these three categories of voters did not switch their votes for Hitler. We know that women, first-time voters, that is young women and young people, disproportionately voted for Hitler, but a majority of women never voted for Hitler. But that last-minute bandwagon effect was fueled in part by people who'd never voted before, that is young people and women. So that's before 33. After 33, when it became clear that the Nazis would be in power for some time to come, and remember, the Nazis right from the beginning were arresting communists, they were arresting people who spoke out against them. The first concentration camp in Dachau was set up in 1933 right away, and suddenly the Nazis became the real party. And ordinary people, middle-class people, began to think, well, maybe it's not so bad because we are not being affected. Our lives are doing better. And, of course, there's the famous statement by a very famous pastor, Martin Niemöller, oh, when they came for the socialists, when they came for the communists, I didn't worry, and then they came for the Catholics. Oh, and when they came for me, there was no one left to defend me. And people got seduced.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and A Nazi Conscience, and we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past. And that reminds me of something, because I was thinking about this, and it was very good that there was this large women's march just after Trump's inauguration, but it raised something else to me in terms of the people that need to be in the streets now and doing all kinds of things now to stand up against Trump. And I thought of one thing that in particular people need to understand, because if you went around telling people, look, you're talking about fascism, you're talking about a fascist there, you're talking about somebody who, if you study what happened in Germany, you study that, you study what's happened in other places, but in particular Germany, you look at this and you can draw a lot of line between what goes on with Trump and what was going on with Hitler and the Nazis. Now, you wrote, and I wanted to give people just a sense in general about this. Like, after the Women's March, I was thinking about your book, Mothers in the Fatherland, and Women, the Family, and Nazi Politics, and it was a very heavy book. And I wanted to ask you about that. What did fascism mean for women in Germany? Because it's one thing when you hear about the men and what happened to them and how they were appealed to, and it was all the stuff that was going on specifically aimed at men, but there was a lot of stuff that was happening with women that I thought was very, very heavy and sort of, one, denied their humanity, but two, was something that a lot of people just don't know about in relation to fascism.
That's why I wrote the book, because I was in the 80s, and all my friends in Germany said, oh, yeah, my dad was bad, but my mother was really good. And so I went to the archives, and I found out that actually when you want to know how Hitler's ideology permeated at the grassroots, women are at the center of that story. They're the mothers who send their kids off to the Hitler Youth. They're the local knitting society that gets brown yarn for free. They call themselves, some of them call themselves, Hitler's little brown geese. Can you imagine? That they were proud of being recognized as women. The head of the organization, I kid you not, the name was really Gertrud Schultz-Klink. Gertrud Schultz-Klink headed up an organization of 9 million women, all out there volunteering, collecting charity for the needy, cooking meals for the hungry, organizing charity. Everything was organized, even charity. And so women felt proud of doing their womanly activities, womanly so-called. And the fact that they were kept out of high places didn't bother them as much as we might think it would. Not that many women were in the universities to begin with.
The other place that actually was had a lot to do with like what happened with Hitler's reputation, what happened with fascism in Germany, and how it was rolled out a carpet for them to be received on was in the universities. And the fact that the universities actually were very open to Hitler. And that was something that really, I think, would shock a lot of people. To me, it was interesting because when I saw you really went after Heidegger, I was very happy because you don't know how many arguments I've had with people about Heidegger. And, you know, people always look at him as like, oh, well, you know, we study him. So let's talk about this. What about the universities and the Nazis, the relationship there?
You would think. I work in a university, so I would think that the universities would be the first to see the danger. Not at all. First of all, actually, Jewish professors were overrepresented in the ranks of academe, and 10% of all professors were fired because they were Jewish in 1933. And in a time when there were no jobs available, that meant a lot of PhDs got jobs. So there's that absolutely material benefit. And while we're talking about Jews, also too, middle-class professors were about as anti-Semitic as other people, but while we're talking about Jews, I'd like to ask your listeners to imagine, think of what percentage of all Germans in 1933 were Jewish. Just pause for a minute, get that percentage correct, and I bet not many of you guessed under 1%. So we're looking at a very small population, quite different from the population, the African-American population, which is around 15 to 18% in this country. And so there's a very big difference. And the amount of anti-Semitism in the universities was actually quite strong. And so that was one reason. The other thing that the Hitler administration did is to recruit followers in the universities who would serve as legal experts, who would justify racial politics. The funding dried up for what we would call liberal research, but funding was suddenly available for research in race. How race impacts literature, racial thinking impacts social work. So the racialization of the curriculum meant all kinds of new funding opportunities. And so as we're looking to what's going to happen now about funding for climate change, we can see that kind of incentive system shifting. And so suddenly the availability of jobs, funding, and prestige was irresistible. And I have to say that the historians were particularly awful. They took a lot of the history that had been written by Jews, talking about all of Jews' wonderful contributions in many, many areas, and they took all that research and they said, see, there's been a Jewish conspiracy. They just plagiarized and turned pride into insult. So the universities were not a bastion of free speech.
It's very heavy reading that in your book. In fact, as you go through it and you get all the way up to 39 and the role that the universities played, I mean, they were like steamrollers for Hitler. It was very, very heavy.
They called it the brown steamroller.
Well, let's talk about this because I want to start getting into some of the similarities between what's happening with the Trump regime and what happened in Nazi Germany. And one of the things I can't help, and I think I wrote to you earlier about this, but you talked a lot about the professional popularizers for the Nazi regime. One put out the booklet called Der Stürmer, and the other was Das Schwarze Korps. And I read this part of the book, I kept thinking about, guess what, Breitbart. And this is kind of right there, you know?
It's right there. And of course, now we look back and the technology was primitive. But the Nazis, and one thing to remember is before 33, no politics on the radio. So radio was not an option. But the Nazis were way ahead of the curve. As soon as electric amplification of the voice became possible, they had it. They had movies. They used film strips. They had 72,000 versions of one slideshow that went out but displayed by the Hitler Youth. They were at the technological front of the media always. They had insiders, newspapers for party members, and huge mass circulation newspaper, their own national news circulation, with fake news, fake facts everywhere. And this was very, very important. that they were technologically night and day more sophisticated than any of their other political rivals.
You know, one thing that I kept thinking about as I was reading about this, now these two, particularly Der Stürmer and Das Schwarze Korps, these were two different publications, right? These were print publications, and one was from the SS and one was from the Stormtroopers, right? And one was geared towards a sort of a more brutish audience, and the other was geared towards a more intellectual audience, it seemed. So what? Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, because they understood how to segment their audience. And so that the Stürmer was filled with disgusting anti-Semitic cartoons and outrageous lies, like the National Enquirer. But the Schwarze Korps, which is for the SS, which is the elite, had scientific articles. It had pictures of important people. It looked like a professional association in the day. It had racial science there. It had geopolitics. It had interviews with government dignitaries. It appealed to the elite.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and A Nazi Conscience, and we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on recent developments in the U.S. and the threat of the consolidation of a fascist government here. Let me ask you this, and this is something you also have been thinking about a lot as you wrote to me this morning, the structural similarities and situations that encourage racist populism. And, you know, this is exactly what we're looking at when we're looking at the regime in power in the U.S. right now in terms of this kind of encouraging racist populism. And let's talk about that, the structural similarities in these situations.
Well, you know, I can't resist pointing out to one enormous difference. And that is, of course, the structural similarities are here. We have a group of people who feel left out, left behind. But our situation in some ways is different because, and that's why I think fascism isn't so helpful, because we have a unique situation. When you look at the white supremacy tradition in this country, we've been a country that has been for 270 years, my math is probably a little weak, we have been a country where white supremacy has been legal all years except for 77 years. Except for 77 years, we have been a white supremacist country. That didn't exist in Germany. And that makes us structurally incredibly different, and I think we always have to remember we're more like apartheid in South Africa under de Klerk than in that respect than in Nazi Germany. So it's important when we're doing the comparisons to remember that there are some alarming differences too, not necessarily better. But structurally, we have a developed democracy that people take for granted. We think our wonderful history is going to protect us because we tend to think of history as being upward and onward, always getting better. We don't see it as a battle. We have two traditions in this country, the tradition of the Enlightenment, the tradition of human rights, human dignity, and then we have the tradition of white supremacy, and they're both confronting one another right now. And Germany didn't have that legacy of white supremacy, and the Jewish population was minuscule. So that's one element that makes us different.
What about the similarities on the other hand?
Well, similarities, I can't resist drawing some similarities in the way in which people seem to follow an outsider leader. Now, you can look at Hitler, and of course, he's ridiculous. He's got a shock of hair. He had no political experience. He got the idea for his mustache when he saw his first Charlie Chaplin movie. He had himself, he was extremely vain. He particularly liked that mop of hair that came down in front of his eyes. He had a photographer with him at all times. The photographer took pictures of his gestures, which he repeated. He could not follow a script. He had to extemporaneously speak because he had to have feedback from his audience. And in fact, in 1932, he was so vain, his photographer, personal photographer, took dozens of pictures for him in different poses so that his annual picture wouldn't look aged. He curated an image for himself, the opposite of Trump, but therefore interesting because it was extreme. He's a simple man, a bachelor, a teetotaler, a vegetarian who wore rumpled suits. He appeared kind of harmless. So that, in an odd way, won him the trust of people who were so disillusioned with the main political parties of the day. So from the opposite end of the social scale, we have this outsider capturing the disenfranchised, people who feel disenfranchised, because of an extraordinary ability to understand the media. Hitler also was a master at making headlines of the provocative statement. He would always make outrageous statements. Didn't matter if they weren't so true. He said, tell a lie, tell a big lie. It always leaves a trace.
Let's talk about this. You mentioned to me that you're very worried these days, and I want to talk about that because I think you're not alone, okay?
I'm very worried today because in some ways, Hitler was more cautious. He had to be more cautious because of the Constitution, because there was a president over him, and he never got more than a third of the vote. And there was no voter fraud in Nazi Germany, P.S. I'm very worried because what I see is a president whose ignorance is legendary, and he has a Rasputin, Steve Bannon. Hitler didn't need anybody else. Hitler read whole books, believe it or not. He only remembered what he agreed with, but still. I think I'm worried because we, like the Germans, have a political culture that depends on goodwill and shared norms, politicians who respect those norms. We take it for granted. We're looking at a regime that has a businessman's ethic, and a businessman looks for loopholes and looks at respect for your enemy, so-called, respect for your person in the other party, as being a sign of weakness or stupidity. We also have a track record in this country, a right-wing movement that's extremely well-funded. Read Dark Money. I think what frightens me most is that progressives in pre-Nazi Germany, in late Weimar Germany, progressives were blindsided by the speed and the ruthlessness with which Hitler seized power. Remember Franklin Roosevelt said in the 30s, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. I think the only thing we have to fear is not being afraid enough. Even though the parallels are not perfect with Nazi Germany, what is similar is the weakness of progressives, people of goodwill, liberals, lefties, call them what you will, defenders of human rights, our weakness when confronted with overwhelming force. So that's why I'm scared.
Well, you got me too. Claudia Kunz, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Talk to you again soon.
Thanks.
Take care now.
Bye.
And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.